Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. This morning, we'll be talking about the music business and about how, in, say, the mid-90s, advances in technology that made it very easy to play music, to store it, to put it in your pocket and carry it wherever you go, to share it with your friends. This technology made all those things very easy, certainly much easier than it had ever been before. The big players in the music industry, they just weren't ready for this change. And instead of trying to look for ways to take advantage of that new technology, they spent an enormous amount of time and money and energy in what was an ultimately unsuccessful effort to fight it. This morning, we'll be talking a little bit about what all this has meant for the people who create, who market, and consume music. And our guest for the program is Greg Kott. He is the music critic for the Chicago Tribune, and has been doing that since 1990. He also writes a blog, Turn It Up, that's hosted by the paper. He's co-host of the nationally syndicated radio program Sound Opinions, and he's written also for Rolling Stone, Details, Blender, Entertainment Weekly, Men's Journal, Guitar World, and Vibe. And he's the author of a recently published book titled Ripped, How the Wired Generation Revolutionized Music. It's published by Scribner, and it's out in bookstores now if you want to take a look at it. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you can pick up the telephone and give us a call and be part of the conversation. The only thing we ask is people just try to be brief in their questions and comments so we can get in as many callers as possible, but anybody who's listening is welcome to call. Well, Greg Kott, hello.
Hi, David.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
I certainly appreciate it. I think what you're making here is you're really making an argument here that says that, maybe there were winners and losers in this, but that if you ask really who wins, you would say, first of all, people who love music win. And also you would say that I think that this technology has been really good for a lot of musicians who otherwise would have found it very difficult to get their music heard.
Exactly. I think what has happened with the music industry in the last 50 years is that the pipeline for getting music out has been becoming narrower and narrower. It's more difficult than ever to, under that old system, to be exposed as an artist. And I think the number one obstacle in front of any new band, any creative person, is to get their work heard before the public. And that was becoming really difficult under the old system. And I think what's happened now with the technology, with the internet, with file sharing, it's leveled the playing field. It's allowed bands and artists to communicate directly with fans without having to go through this narrow pipeline created by these middlemen, basically the music industry as we know it from the 20th century. And just do an end run around that industry and communicate directly with their fans. And that has, I think, exponentially increased their opportunities for having their music exposed and also to make a living off of their music.
Yeah. And certainly I think that people, one of the things that people, again, people who would say that they really like music, they like finding out about new bands that they'd never heard before, their complaints about the big music companies was that their idea of what they could sell was so narrow. And in fact, if we go back before MP3s, before file sharing became such a big thing, and when the CD was actually the, I guess, the main way that people bought music and listened to music, there was actually a period where the record companies, that dates me, I still say record companies, the big music companies were really doing very well, but the way that they were doing it was by selling enormous numbers of just a handful of CDs. And so what you had was you got the companies getting to this time when what they really wanted, what everybody wanted, the next Thriller, so that they could sell a bazillion copies of this one thing. And as long as they could do that, they could make a lot of money.
Right. I mean, you could sell, a big record company could sell 10 million copies of a blockbuster album, whether it was by U2 or Michael Jackson or Coldplay or Pearl Jam, and that would pay for a lot of duds. But you had a success-failure ratio of about 1 to 9, you know. 90% of the records that were released by the major labels by the late 90s were considered failures. That's a pretty bad business model when it comes right down to it, and you're totally dependent on these big-selling records to sort of make your nut. And, once they stop cranking out those 10 million sellers. I mean, the last era of that was really around 98, 99, you know, with the wave of the Backstreet Boys and NSYNC and Britney Spears. And those were basically fads that went away after a couple of years. And then once those fads went away, the record industry is looking around, well, wait a minute, what do we do now, you know?
Yeah.
And basically the industry just got stolen right from underneath them.
Well, I know, and this is something I know, I'm sure that you've been asked about, that you wonder whether, what's the potential for an act that would sell at that level ever, almost ever again? And I suppose then the next question is, well, if you say it's low, then you might have to say, well, so what? I mean, is that, do we really cry, or do we say, well, that we actually have a model now that we can go to that says, well, we're going to have a different definition of what we're going to consider to be success.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. Yeah. I think, you know, I've been asked this question a lot the last couple of months about the book, and where's the next, you know, where's the next Beatles coming from? Where's the next U2 coming from? And I go, do we really want that? I mean, is that something that's really important to us now? I think what that means now means a lot different than what the Beatles meant in 1964 or U2 might have meant in 1987 when they broke big. That whole notion of creating something that is that popular, you know, factors in a whole lot of other effects that I think dilute essentially the music. What you're talking about now when you're talking that level of popularity is really a multimedia celebrity, along the lines of a Jennifer Lopez or a Madonna or something like that. Somebody who does music is just one of many things that they do. And they're actually a much larger celebrity than they are as a music person. But I think for the hardcore music fan, for somebody who really loves music, the whole notion of art being created, the possibilities, first of all, I think are endlessly infinite right now. I mean, it just in terms of how you can make a living off of music, I think there's a real possibility, David, for the first time in the last 50, 60 years of a true artistic middle class being created because of what file sharing has done. I think the way the industry operated in the past, it was either a have or a have-nots industry. As I said, 10% haves, 90% have-nots. Now I think you have the real possibility where you can have bands who aren't necessarily selling, you know, tens of millions of records or even a million records, but are selling, you know, maybe 50,000 records, maybe 30,000, maybe even less than that, but are making a decent living off of various types of revenue streams, whether it's licensing those songs, whether it's merchandise, T-shirts, et cetera, playing shows. There's a real possibility of, you know, making $75,000 a year off of your music. And I think a lot of artists would say, hey, that's great. You know, I don't have to work at Kinko's, you know, in order to subsidize my music making. I can just go out and play music for a year and make $75,000. I think that's a more real possibility now than it would have been 10 years ago.
And I guess I know this is sort of jumping ahead, but one of the concerns all along here has been raised about these new technologies like the MP3 and peer-to-peer services like Napster, where people can exchange their music, and the fact that generally there are many different ways to get music without paying for it. So the question is, well, that's if that happens, and if that happens a lot, it's money out of the pocket of the musicians. And one might say that, well, if you're selling a million units and you got some unauthorized copying, it's literally someone is stealing, that's something that you can absorb. But maybe if you're only selling 30,000 units, mm-hmm. that becomes a bigger problem. And I think, you know, for all of the people that want to make the content wants to be free argument, there still seems to be a big question about how it is that people manage to make a living and get some reward for their creative effort.
Well, here's the dirty little secret of the music business for the last 50 years is that artists never made money off of recorded music. It was a very small percentage of artists who actually made any kind of a living off of recording royalties. The vast majority of money was made always through touring or through merchandise or through anything but recorded music. Essentially, the recorded piece of music was an advertisement for everything else that an artist did. The money was made by the record company. They paid for the record, and they were the ones accruing the revenue from the sales of that recorded music. But the music, the revenue, the royalties very seldom trickled down to the artist level. You know, you had Roger McGuinn, the founder of the Byrds, testifying in Congress in the mid-90s that he never made a penny of royalties from the sales of a Byrds record, which is you think that's just absurd. I mean, the Byrds were one of the most important groups of the 60s and 70s, and yet he never got paid a royalty for a record sale. So that whole argument I find kind of specious, because I think, well, wait a minute, you know, you never got paid under the old system. You know, here you've got an opportunity now to speak directly to your fans and use recorded music as a way of advertising yourself as an artist in a more direct way than ever. And if you do sell any recorded music, the vast majority of the money will come to you rather than the vast majority of the money coming to the record company and you getting sort of the leftovers.
Yeah, so if you can distribute your own music, then you're making the direct connection between you and the consumer, and so that should mean that even, you know, so okay, so maybe there are some people who get it without paying for it, that ought to, given that you should be doing better overall, maybe you say, okay, we can absorb a little bit of that.
Yeah, I think too that there's also the argument that I think is false in all this, is that somehow a file that is shared or ripped off or however you want to look at it, somebody downloads a piece of your music and then doesn't pay for it, that automatically represents a lost sale. It may be just somebody, it's important to look at this as kind of more like a radio station, just an elaborate radio station, or a way of getting your music out to the world and letting people sample it, hear it, decide whether or not they like it. Not all those people are going to buy. They may hear it and they may say, you know, hey, that's not for me. That's something I want to own. But a percentage of those people are going to say, hey, I like it. I want to hear more of this. The next time this guy comes to town, I want to go see the show. They see the show, they're blown away. They tell 10 of their friends about it. And the next time you come through town, you've got more people out of that show when you play that same town. I think the idea of using the music as a marketing and an advertising tool in this way is profoundly increased. And, you know, you think about a band like Metallica, who I wrote about in the book and who have been notoriously adamant against file sharing. They were one of the first bands to go out and sue Napster, saying, you know, hey, you can't do this. You know, you can't take our music and distribute it to these people and allow people to hear our music. Well, I still have a tape of a tape of a tape of the first Metallica EP that I got that originated from Lars Ulrich, the drummer of Metallica, making 100 copies of that first EP, sending it to his friends and said, send this to as many people as you can. And as a result of that, word of mouth, cassette being handed to a person, and that person burning 10 cassettes and handing it to 10 more people, word of mouth spread about this great new metal band, Metallica, and people started coming to the shows, and the band became, you know, one of the biggest bands in the world 20 years later. But it all started with that sort of grassroots, hand-to-mouth campaign of, you know, here's our music, listen to it, what do you think? And that's where it's got to start with every band. I think the bands who are troubled by the way things have changed in the last 10 years are the ones who are entrenched, who have made some money off of the old system, like the Metallicas of the world. But I think for the vast majority of the bands who weren't really making any money under this old system, except for the stuff the money they were making on the road, I think this system allows them to get the music out to more people than ever, and also to, you know, acquire things like email addresses and have a build up a fan base on a grassroots level that was never really possible with the way the old music industry was operating.
Our guest is Greg Kot. He's music critic at the Chicago Tribune, has been doing that since 1990. He has a blog, Turn It Up, that's hosted by the paper. He's co-host of the nationally syndicated radio program Sound Opinions and has written for a number of other publications. He's the author of the newly published book, Ripped, How the Wired Generation Revolutionized Music. It is published by Scribner. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let me just real quick pass on to folks who are listening to us a weather announcement that's just been handed to me by our weather guy, Mike Sola. This is a severe thunderstorm watch. It will be in effect for parts of central Illinois until 4 o'clock this afternoon, and in the severe weather coverage area that we have staked out, it includes DeWitt, Ford, Livingston, Logan, and McLean counties. And again, this is a severe thunderstorm watch. Will be in effect until 4 o'clock this afternoon. We're expecting that we've had some heavy rain here early this morning in our area and around us, and we're expecting the chance of severe storms developing again this afternoon. So keep it tuned here to AM 580, and we will keep you informed of what's going on with the weather. One of the things that I'm interested in having you talk about, you know, I think that one of the concerns that had been raised about, again, this, you know, MP3s and the ability of people to get music for free and pass it around, was that it was argued that if people could get music for free, they wouldn't go out and buy music, and that that overall maybe that would be bad for music, for musicians, for the business. Other people said, no, that's not true. I mean, it's anything that gets people excited about music is good, and that we shouldn't expect that people are actually going to buy less music. They might even buy more music. Who knows? How has that worked out?
Well, I think the whole idea of buying music, I mean, you know, it's interesting. You know, I lost the initial thread of that question. Can I get you to return back to fascinating thread? But I want to.
I have this way of asking questions that are really too long and complicated. I guess the question is, if people can get music, some people said, okay, if folks can get music for free, they won't pay for music anymore.
Right.
Another folks said, well, no, that may not necessarily be true, and that it may be that people are actually. They're listening more to more kinds of music. They're listening to more music, and maybe even when it comes to paying for it, they're actually even buying more music.
I think, you know, there's a definite argument to be made that anytime there's a technological advance, like, you know, for example, file sharing, that even though there was some downside to it, like, oh, people are accessing this music and they can get it for free and they're never going to have to pay for another piece of music ever again. I think history tells us otherwise. You know, you look back to the phonograph, you know, a century ago, and that was invented. And there was an outcry within the music community that, oh, you know, why are people ever going to have to, you know, step foot outside their house again to go see a concert when they can buy a record? And then when radio started playing music, people were saying, well, why will they ever need to buy a phonograph ever again if they can get all their music for free on the radio? And then when cassettes came around in the late 70s, early 80s, there was this, you know, the industry was taking out full-page ads in magazines saying, home taping is killing music. You know, you're going to be able to tape all your records and nobody will ever have to buy a record again. You know, one person will buy it and 10 people will tape it. And each of those arguments proved to be incredibly foolhardy because all these innovations did was exponentially increase the appetite for music. People heard music and they wanted more of it. The more they heard, the more they wanted it. Music will never go away. Music will never lose popularity. Music, in fact, there are more people than ever in the history of the world listening to more music than ever right now, and thanks in large measure to the internet. So you've got this amazing potential audience out there that is listening to more music than ever. The notion that, okay, not everybody's going to buy that music right away, you know, okay, that's fine. Not everybody has to buy right away, but they're going to want it in their lives. And I think the key is if you're good, you know, people are going to want more of it. That's the key. I hear a lot of people complaining about not getting paid. Well, my question to them is, you know, are you any good? You know, I mean, just because people hear your music doesn't mean they have to buy it. And I think one of the reasons that there was this rebellion against what was going on in the music world in the late 90s was that people were paying $17.99, $18.99 for a CD, and they may have only wanted one song. Or they were led to believe that this band was good based on a video they saw on MTV or something. But the only way to access this band was to buy this $18.99 CD. It would be like Coca-Cola saying to you, I know you want just a sample. You want this 12-ounce can, but I'm only going to sell it to you in the 64-ounce bottle. That's the only way you can buy it. You got to pay this full price for this big container. And, you know, here are these people saying, I just want a sample. I just want a taste. I want a single. You know, the fact that that entree point that countless generations of listeners had used to get into music, buying the single, was basically taken away from them. And basically, you know, the industry turned around and said, you got to buy the 16, 17-song CD at $17.99. You know, that just set an entire atmosphere for, hey, things have got to change. You are not listening to how consumers consume music. And I think the industry has no one to blame but itself for what has happened in the last 10 years.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point that a lot of people have made, that one of the big mistakes that the industry made was getting rid of the single, and that in effect what an MP3 is, that's what it is, and that you might well have a hard sell getting people to buy a whole, however many 15, 17 tracks, yep, however much you want to pay, but you could the idea that you could sell a whole lot of individual songs, because you're saying to people, okay, you'd like to have the song, how about 99 cents? That's 99 cents, that's like nothing. And I'm sure a lot of people would say, well, yeah, that's not much. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, Apple has demonstrated that it's possible to make significant amounts of money selling one song at a time for 99 cents.
Yeah, I think, that's a kind of a vital price point. I mean, iTunes has since, they've got the variable pricing now where certain songs are now $1.29. They basically raised the price 30% for some of the newer, hotter songs. But I think that's a fair price, 99 cents. I think it could be even lower, and they could probably even increase their volume a bit more. I think the key, though, with iTunes or any music store is selection. iTunes still doesn't have a huge number of significant artists in their store, and I think consumers are frustrated by that. Consumers, if they could get any piece of music they wanted with the click of a button and pay a reasonable price for what will be a high quality digital file of that music, I think they would pay for that. I think they would certainly pay a reasonable price for that. But as yet, the record companies haven't been able to agree on any kind of common ground on some of these areas. Some of the artists aren't playing ball with some of these music stores. So as a result, you have this sort of hodgepodge system where each of these legitimate music stores is somehow incomplete and less, less accommodating than some of these rogue file sharing services like LimeWire, where basically you can find just about anything you want for nothing. So you're competing against basically an entire world of recorded music that's instantly available for free versus a system where it's a kind of an incomplete file of music. Added to this, all the restrictions they put on how much you can share that music, and then you throw a price point on top of it. You've got all these things mitigating against it. I think if there ever came a day where the music industry could agree and say, listen, we're going to make every piece of recorded music available, there are going to be no restrictions, it's going to be high digital download rate, and it's going to be at a fair price, under $1 per song, I think you definitely have a market for that. People would sign up for that. They would be lining up around the block to sign up for that.
Yeah.
But they're not making that available to them right now because they can't seem to agree on how to do this.
Let's talk with some folks. Let's go to line one first in Savoy. Hello.
Hello. Something I've been curious about for a long time. If you do want to support someone, what's the best way to purchase? Does it matter if you go to a big box store or a boutique or a paid download? Which gets them the most royalties?
Well, the best way to do it is to buy directly from the artist. If you can buy directly from the website, most artists will have a setup on their website where they will make their music available for you to sample and for you to buy if you want. And they will inevitably have either a direct purchase method or a link to the method that they prefer. So I would check if you're interested in a particular artist. I would check the artist's website first. That is usually your best option. I think, once you start dealing with a big box store, you're introducing a whole lot of other elements that get between the artist and your dollar. So there's no guarantee that your dollar is going to trickle down to the artist. So I would say the direct method is the best if you can do that.
Do you know if it makes a difference to the artist if you buy it via Walmart or the local guy at the end of the corner?
My answer to that would be that local guy in the corner needs your dollar more for that CD than Best Buy does, and nothing against Best Buy or Walmart. It's just that for them, a lot of these CDs are loss leaders. It's like, get into our store, buy a CD, and come out with a refrigerator. You know, it's like they want you to buy something else when you're in there. They're not really making any money off CDs. In fact, that's one of the reasons that the selection of CDs at Walmarts and Best Buys around the country are actually shrinking, because it's not a huge moneymaker for them. Whereas that guy at the corner mom-and-pop store, he needs that money to stay in business. I mean, that's basically the bottom line there. In a lot of ways, that guy is going to be more knowledgeable and is going to be able to tell you, you know, what based on your preferences, what kind of music you would like to hear. So he's probably more likely to be able to steer you to something you're going to like. And I'm just a big advocate of that grassroots kind of independent record store. That has been the lifeblood of music for, you know, the last 30 or 40 years, and I'd love to see them stay in business.
All right, thank you.
All right, thank you. Next to cell phone here, line two. Hello.
Hi. I had another concern about the topic you're talking about today, and that is the creativity of the artist, because it seems to me that the big CD companies took over rap music, for example. It started out as a very, very politically astute commentary on society and on the conditions of people. And then when the record companies took it over and they realized what would sell, then it degenerated into just selling sex. And if what you're talking about today, you know, of individual artists being able to, you know, produce their own songs and distribute them and make profit, that's great. But I also think the actual ideas of the artist can be better protected if they're controlling it, as opposed to record companies taking it over just so they can make a profit.
Well, I think there's no doubt that once you introduce, you know, large sums of money into any equation, it's gonna have an effect on whatever it is that's being done. In the case of creative enterprise like music, there's certainly a lot of evidence that money has corrupted a certain level of artistry. You create a formula and then you try to repeat the formula because it made you money.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, hip hop is a good example of, you know, an art form that was corrupted by the fact that a certain sound and a certain style of music made money, and now they're trying to repeat the formula where the creativity's been sucked out of it, and now it's all about the marketing dollars.
Right.
So, you know, but, you know, at the same time, the big labels have given us a lot of amazing music over the years. It's not necessarily that it's a bad thing to be on a big label, but I think overall the idea is, I think the big labels are now, as I was saying earlier, kind of in the multimedia celebrity business. They are built to create superstars, and when they're not building superstars, they don't know what to do. They don't know what to do with a band that can sell maybe, you know, 75,000-100,000 records, which is a huge sum for most independent labels in the country. But for a major label, it isn't even worth putting out a record like that. So
right.
You're saying, well, why do we need to bother with these kind of fringe artists? So as a result, a lot of good music is sort of being kicked to the margins. But I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think an artist these days has to be very careful about signing with a major label and realizing what you're getting yourself into, because you're talking about a marketing machine unlike anything else. But that's what they do. They market stuff, and when your stuff isn't selling, then they're going to drop you like a hot potato.
Yeah.
You know, if you're in it for the music and you're in it for the art, there's a lot better way to do it, and I think the way to start doing it is by lowering your overhead and going with a small kind of infrastructure. I'm not saying bands should do it by themselves, but I think they can do it with one or two astute business people around them, helping them do what they want to do independently through their own website or through their self-created record label. Again, I think it's a question of your goals. If you want to be a multi-billionaire, if you want to be Madonna, then sign with Warner Brothers. But if you want to make music for a living, I think you go out on your own and give that a shot.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. And we'll go to another caller here on a cell phone. This is line three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My problem has always been with the samples some of these websites put up. You know, you get 20, 30 seconds of somewhere in the middle of the song. You don't really get the feel for the entire song.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to buy the entire thing or, you know, the entire CD or whatever. And then it's still a pick and a poke. Why don't they just... Like AM radio was lo-fi, but it got the music out there. Why don't they just release lo-fi cuts of the entire song, you know, okay, maybe not 64-bit, maybe 24-bit, something so you can get a kind of a feel for it, but you wouldn't want to listen to it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
If you liked it enough, then buy the hi-fi version of it.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think any smart band is doing that now. I mean, perhaps the most famous example was Radiohead when they self-released their 2007 record In Rainbows, and they did exactly what you said. They made a low bit rate file available to anybody who wanted to download it. It said, here it is, the whole album. They not only streamed it, they allowed fans to download it and keep it if they wanted to, but it was a low bit rate file. It wasn't the high fidelity version of the record, but they said, hey, if you like this, live with it for a few months, and then when we make the physical version or if we make the higher bitrate version available, maybe you'll want to buy it. Well, it was wildly successful. They ended up selling 3.1 million copies of a record that they basically made available for free. So your example is exactly right. I think if you treat the audience with respect and with intelligence and say, listen, here's our stuff, take a listen to it. If you like it, buy it. If not, no big deal. That's the way to go. Give people more rather than less. I totally agree with you. These 20, 30-second bites of songs do nothing for anybody. That said, I think more and more bands, I'm seeing more band websites where bands are making entire songs available. You go to most MySpace pages right now for any band that you can think of, and you will hear a minimum of 4 songs that are being streamed in their entirety. So I think bands are getting the idea that, yes, this is like radio. Let's let people hear the full song before they make a decision. I think that's the only way to go.
And that's okay for a current band that's, shall we say, in production. I, however, am a bit older, and when looking for previous things that have been released, stuff that's been unavailable until, you know, recently, maybe the company will just re-release it on CD, and they'll release an entire catalog, and you don't know what's out there, really, because you can't get always a feel for what's out there.
Yeah. Well, again, I think there's a lot of flaws in the way, you know, people are being asked to access music. This is why I have these reservations about, like, iTunes and a lot of these legit music stores. A lot of the stuff that you want just isn't on there. Whereas you go to some of these rogue sites, and you can find just about anything you want. So, you know, the music is out there. There is a day coming, and I think it's sooner rather than later, where every piece of recorded music ever is going to be available pretty readily. And, you know, it's only a matter of the technology catching up with it, and it's catching up with it very fast right now. But, you know, the capabilities are there to do that sort of thing. And I think it's very soon before people realize, hey, this is the way people want to access music. Let's get it out there. Let's make it available rather than hoarding it and hiding it. It's like you said, if people can't hear it, why would they want to buy it?
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest is Greg Kot. He's the music critic at the Chicago Tribune, has been since 1990. His Tribune-hosted blog is Turn It Up. A lot of people who are interested in music look at that. He's the co-host of the nationally syndicated radio show Sound Opinions. He's also written for Rolling Stone, Details, Blender, Entertainment Weekly, Men's Journal, Guitar World, and Vibe, and is the author of the recently published book, Ripped, How the Wired Generation Revolutionized Music. So if you want to read more about what it is we're talking about, you can look for the book. It's published by Scribner. Questions here are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The record companies, when file sharing really started to get big, the record companies, they were just crazy about it, in the sense that crazy that they wanted to stop it, and tried very hard to kill it. They attacked the people who were hosting it. They attacked the people who were downloading. Then along comes Steve Jobs, who showed them that you could actually do this and set it up in a way that it would work, and that people actually would be willing to pay money for the music. And you know, they're all the shortcomings that we've talked about, but it certainly worked. And now I do believe that Apple is the biggest music retailer in the country. Why was it that nobody in the music industry, you know, it took a computer guy to say, hey, wait a minute, there's a way that you can take advantage of this downloading thing and make money at it.
Yeah, I think if Jobs had been running the music industry in 1997 or so, I think they would be a lot better off than they are. As it is, Jobs is one of the guys that's making a mint off of this current, you know, trend that is only going to become more powerful in the next, you know, century. What's interesting about Jobs, I think, is that he's not really making a lot of money off of the music per se. I mean, the iTunes store is successful, but it's not super successful. He did say it's the biggest retailer. And in that sense, yeah, you know, it's doing fine, but he's making way more money off of the iPod.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those suckers are selling, I think he sold about 150 million of them or something like that. And, you know, do the math on that at an average of about $300 per, you know. I mean, he's making a lot of money off of hardware. And I think the music industry is really upset because here's this guy, basically what Paul McGinnis of U2, the manager of U2, said is a high-tech burglary kit because, you know, even Jobs has said that about 3% of the music on the average iPod has been purchased from an iTunes store. The rest, 97%, how did it get there? You know, well, some people downloaded their ripped their CD collection and put it on their iPod. But, you know, a lot of people are just filling up their iPod with music that they're getting through less than legal means, you know. So it's interesting that the music has become this sort of disposable quantity, whereas the iPod has become the fetish object, the object that everyone wants to have. So it's kind of skewed the equation. So as much as, you know, Jobs is hailed as this visionary guy, well, he is a visionary in terms of making money, but in terms of finding a way to make the music cool again, he's not really that guy, you know, because most people who own iPods, they've got these 10,000 songs on their iPods, and then every 6 months they replenish them. They get rid of those songs and they put a bunch more on there because it's so easy to access. It has become this disposable quantity, and that's kind of a disturbing thing that the media or the medium has become more important than the media, and it's kind of a twist on this whole formula. It's like if the phonograph had become more important than the record that is actually being played on it, you know. I think that's kind of that is a dilemma that I think the current generation of listeners is going to have to confront, because when Radiohead made In Rainbows available for download back in 2007, they basically said, hey, come to our website, sample the music, buy it if you want. You know, people hit the price tag and they said, okay, it's up to you. That's what Radiohead said. And they made people think about that central issue. What is music worth to you? What is art worth to you? And I think we're going to have to answer that question in the next 10 or 20 years because, face it, everything that has to do with that has to do with intellectual property, intellectual copyright, whether it's books, music, movies, all these art forms are going to be digitized, and they are going to be widely available, and it's going to be easy to access them, and you won't have to pay a penny to access them. So we as a society, we as a culture, are going to have to decide what this stuff is worth to us and how we're going to subsidize the people who create out there.
Bloomington, Illinois. I have another caller here on our toll-free line, line 4.
Yes, hi.
Yeah, hi.
Jay, I got a couple of questions. You might have answered one about the artist not receiving any royalties on albums or CDs, but I wonder why. Is that how the contract is written? And the other question is, on concert tours, you read the big names, you know, grossing $50 million, $100 million a year. What do they receive? You know, what do they get in their pocket? And in a band like, say, the Rolling Stones or the Eagles, if one performer is more prominent in the band, do they split it differently? And maybe you don't know, but...
Well, it's a lot of questions, and they're all good ones. Let me try to answer the first one as directly as I can. Record industry contracts for a long time have been basically a 90-10 proposition. In other words, Artists make about 10% on every record or every piece of recorded music that's sold. And this only after they have recouped the advance that was paid by the record company to record that music.
Oh, I see.
So in other words, you know, the record company gives you $200,000 to go into a nice recording studio and record with a producer who has to be paid and an engineer who has to be paid. And then you record the record and the record company puts it out. So at a rate of 10% per sale, you have to repay that $200,000. And then when you repay that amount, then you start making royalties on that sale of that recorded music at a rate of 10%. So it's a very slow, arduous process. And let's face it, the record companies have all the accountants on their side. I mean, an artist could potentially hire an independent accountant to go in there and audit the record company books and say, wait a minute, my client is owed X amount of dollars for sales of this record. But most artists aren't in the position to do that. They aren't in the position to hire somebody like that.
Like you two, the very top names, do they still have that type of agreement?
Yeah, well, some of these more successful artists, you know, the Metallicas of the world, the U2s of the world, are able to negotiate higher royalty rates after they have been incredibly successful and made their labels a lot of money. Then when it comes to re-up their contracts, they are able to raise the royalty rate. So in other words, they are able to get paid more per sale. And that's fine for the biggies. But for the vast majority of artists out there, they're making this paltry rate per sale, and most of them never see a dime most of them allegedly never paid off their advance, so they never see a dime on royalties. And your second question about the touring income, you know, it's not atypical for a major band to make $1 million in revenue when they play a stadium. Let's say they go to the local hockey rink and they fill it out with 20,000 fans. You know, that's $1 million-plus night for a lot of these bands.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, some of these bigger bands, I mean, you're talking about like a Rolling Stones-type band. I mean, you know, you'll have 100-plus people on your payroll. So they do have a certain amount of overhead that they've got to deal with. You know, there is expenses to be taken care of. But at the end of the night, that band is probably going to make more in one night than they will on in royalties for, you know, about 6 months off record sales. So it's way, way more lucrative for a band to, at that level, to go on tour and make money. That's why the Rolling Stones still go out there every 3 or 4 years, because that's where they're making their money is, you know, through these mega tours with these mega concert tickets. For a smaller band, too, you know, sales of recorded music are pretty small, but you know, a smaller band can make, you know, $10,000 filling out a club, you know, the size of a Metro in Chicago, for example, you know, which is about 1,000 capacity, you know, and again, they have overhead. They got to pay people. They got to pay a road manager. They got to pay a sound man. They got, you know, whatever. But at the end of the day, they can make a lot more money playing that one show than they can off recorded music sales. So it's really the way a lot of bands go.
Do they split? You know, smaller bands probably just split it four ways or five ways. But the big bands like the Rolling Stones or U2, where one guy is, you know, so much more prominent. Do they? Of course, you may not know. That may just be
Well, you know, in a case of a band like U2, I know that they split it four ways. You know, there are four founding members of that band, and you know, everything is split four ways. You know, whether it's songwriting or royalty or revenue from a night of touring. The Rolling Stones, it's a little different story. They've only got three original members left in that band, and Ron Wood is considered a fourth Rolling Stone, but I'm not sure that he joined the band in 1975, and he's still the new kid on the block. You know, he's still not quite, I don't think he's quite paid at the same rate that the three founding members are paid. So yeah, there are these hierarchies based on, you know, longevity in the band and, you know, pecking order and those kind of things. Absolutely.
All right. I want to thank the caller. We got about 5 minutes left and have one other person. I want to make sure we get them. And that's caller in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Hi, you may address this because I joined the show earlier. It's the pricing of the way you get music nowadays, you know, with the downloads and all that stuff. You don't get an album cover or liner notes or anything like that. And for example, you know, let's use Fleetwood Mac Rumors. I mean, that album came out in the 70s. It was $7 when you bought it. And now if you want to buy it off of iTunes, it's like $15. I'm saying you've made more than enough money off this album 100 times over. Why aren't you selling it at a lower rate?
Yeah.
I don't even get half the stuff that I used to get anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and there's no product to, you know, you don't have to ship it to Best Buy and put it on the shelves and all that stuff. I just don't understand why record companies don't understand it. You know, there's still a market for people that like the older stuff, but you've outpriced yourself again.
Yeah, well, there you go. I mean, I wish you'd been running the record industry in 1998. I think you would have seen this problem ahead of time because that's exactly the point, isn't it? And it's kind of like it's absurd. And especially, as you said, with a download, you know, the overhead on that, there are no manufacturing costs. There are no shipping costs. There are no, you know, paying the retail guy to stock it in the shelves costs. It's you know, you've completely blown out a lot of the costs associated with a physical product. So why is the cost what it is, you know? And there is no logical explanation for it other than pure greed. It makes no sense at all.
You get a guy like me more inclined to buy from iTunes instead of, you know, maybe doing it illegally if you made things more reasonable. I mean, why wouldn't I want to go out and get that album per se illegally? I already own the album, but I want it on my iPod or whatever. So I'm like, well, why should I give it to the record company? It's already given them the money for this album three times already. You know,
it makes it really hard to feel sorry for the record industry when they're
crying
about their fate, isn't it?
They've always found a way to shoot themselves in the foot forever. It seems like.
I don't
understand it.
They're doing it again.
Well, I guess, though, I would say, though, that if, you know, say to take the listener's example, if you really, you know, say maybe you got an old copy of Rumors on vinyl and it's a little scritchy. So you'd say, okay, I'd like to have a new copy of this that sounds good. And you think, well, I could go out and buy a CD of this, and it probably would cost you, I don't know what it would cost, but I'm guessing maybe $16, $17.
Yeah, right.
And then you say, oh, but I can download this from iTunes for $9.99, and it's true, you're not going to get the liner notes, you're not going to get the cover art, but maybe you say, okay, well, what I really want is the music. I guess maybe I'd say I can live with that for the difference in the price between the two things. Now, I wouldn't argue with you to say that, well, I'd be happier if I could get it for $5.99 than $9.99, but it's still a big difference, and so maybe you'll still say, well, $10 is not so bad, especially considering that you'd have to pay $16 or $17 if you want to get the CD.
Right. I mean, you know, the packaging, I think, is a big allure for someone like me, and I think people of a certain generation that grew up with that sort of thing. But it's clearly not an issue with, the new generation, the people under the age of 25 who are downloading music. You know, it's not a major concern. Although there is an interesting caveat here in that vinyl album sales have actually increased the last 2 years. You know, last year was a 90% increase in vinyl album sales, and the first half of this year they're up another 50%, which is amazing. And it's not just old fogies, you know, revisiting their nostalgic past buying this stuff. It's college students who are buying it. And I think a lot of it is that there is sort of an allure to having this physical artifact. It's sort of like collecting art on relatively cheaply. You can't afford a Picasso, but you can afford, you know, the double gatefold sleeve of a Bob Seger record from the 70s. You know, and that's kind of a cool thing to have in your collection. So, it's interesting how that goes, and I don't think that desire to have that physical artifact is ever going to go away. But I also agree with the caller that there is no need for the price of something like that to be as high as it is. I think that's just, you know, it's ridiculous, and it's a turnoff for a lot of fans. I mean, there's still a desire to have this stuff, but not at those price points.
Well, now we got about a minute left. What's next in this? Now that we have gotten to this point where we've got ways to digitally encode music and put it in this tiny package, and so that makes it easy to download, it makes it easy to trade, you can put it on this pocket-sized device and have thousands of songs in your pocket. What's the next thing?
Well, I think the next scenario is is going to be any music, anytime, anywhere. You're going to be able to have that pocket-sized device like you're talking about, you know, basically something the equivalent of an iPod slash cell phone slash BlackBerry that's going to be able to access any piece of recorded music ever made and get it to you and put it in your device and allow you to listen to it at basically a touch of a button. Which is really an amazing thing if you think about it. But I think that scenario is coming up very soon. I think within the next 10 to 15 years we're going to see that reality. And how that is going to be paid for and how artists are going to be compensated, that's a whole other issue. But the fact that all this music is going to be available to all these people with these kind of devices, I mean, that's a huge, huge audience. And now it's a matter of the great thinkers out there to figure out, hey, how are we going to make this work? How are we going to monetize this, to use an economic term?
Yeah.
And that is going to be the central issue of the next 10 or 15 years. But the fact that all of this stuff is going to be widely available to all these people, that is a fact. That is coming soon.
Our guest is Greg Kot. He's music critic at the Chicago Tribune. You want to read his book, it's Ripped, How the Wired Generation Revolutionized Music, published by Scribner. You look for the book. His last name is spelled K-O-T. You can also look for his Tribune-hosted blog, Turn It Up. He's also the co-host of the nationally syndicated radio program, Sound Opinions. Thanks very much for talking with us.
David, my pleasure. Thank you.